This is the Nichols-Patrick Federal Tax Update for July 7, 2014. This update is presented by Nichols-Patrick CPE in conjunction with your State Society of CPAs. Any other use of this material without the express written consent of Nichols-Patrick CPE and your State Society of CPAs is prohibited. These materials are copyright 2014 Nichols-Patrick CPE Incorporated. I'm Ed Zollers, and I'll be discussing a few of the developments that have occurred in the past week in the area of federal taxes. We're going to begin with the IRS's release of additional information regarding their voluntary tax preparer registration program. This was announced in Revenue Procedure 2014-42 that was issued this week. This program follows up a lawsuit the IRS had in the case of Loving versus the United States in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. That program that the IRS had established that was struck down in the Loving case would have required all individuals preparing tax returns to have met certain competency requirements, including passing an exam and having to have obtained continuing education each year in order to be able to continue to prepare returns. As well, that program would have subjected all tax preparers to the provisions of Circular 230 by defining tax practice to include preparation of a tax return even for individuals who had never actually represented a taxpayer in a proceeding before the IRS. The D.C. Circuit found that the IRS lacked the authority to move forward with such a program. In response to that, the IRS has come forward with what they will now call a voluntary program that can be used for tax professionals who are not CPAs, EAs, or attorneys. This program, governed by the Revenue Procedure 2014-42, is designed for preparers primarily who are not CPAs, EAs, or attorneys, the ones we referred to traditionally as unenrolled preparers. The ruling is effective for returns and claims for refunds signed after December 15, 2015, and it revokes, as of that date, a prior Revenue Procedure 81-38. For those of you who maybe don't keep up and remember revenue procedures in detail, I'll remind you that that procedure was the one that said if a person was not a EA, CPA, or attorney, that is, a Circular 230 practitioner, who had the right to represent clients before the IRS, that person could still appear with a taxpayer that was under examination if that person, the unenrolled preparer, had prepared the return in question, signed the return in question. They could appear with the taxpayer in the examination phase. They could not represent them in front of appeals or at any later step in the process, but they were able to go to exams. That procedure will be repealed by this ruling, and it turns out that what the IRS is going to do is require any unenrolled preparer who wants to be able to have the right to go to the exam with the client to come under this program. In this case, only those who have what is going to be called an annual filing season program record of completion, that's the long-winded name for what comes under this program, will be able to represent clients in an examination if they both signed the return in question, prepared and signed the return, and they have that certificate of completion both for the time at which they signed the return, so for that year, and for the year in which the examination is taking place. So, for instance, if we talk about a 2014 tax return that will be completed in 2015, this person would have to have the annual filing season program record of completion for the 2015 season, and that person would also, let's say the IRS examination notice comes in 2017, they would need to be able to have that be a part of that program for 2017 as well. In order to become part of this program, what you have to do is essentially complete what is going to be a 6-hour federal tax update course, and you must answer a written exam, getting at least 70% score on the exam in order to be considered to have passed that particular examination. In this particular case, those people then will be granted the certificate. There are a few other people who can get it without going through the 6-hour course. The ruling says specifically that if a CPA, EA, or attorney, for whatever reason, wants the certificate, they can obtain it. As well, anybody who passed the exam under the prior program, remember that we had a few people who took and passed the exam to be registered tax return preparers, those individuals will be exempted, having passed the old, more comprehensive exam, as well as any tax return preparer that are licensed by a state or territory of the U.S. There are some states that require preparers to be licensed. Those preparers will not have to pass the 70%, will not have to get the 70% score on the six-hour course. Individuals in this program will need to maintain continuing education. They will need to complete 18 hours of approved education from the IRS level. That has to include 2 hours of ethics, 10 hours of federal tax topics other than the update, and 6 hours of federal tax updates. Those who do not have to pass the refresher course and exam, those exempt from that program, will face a reduced CPE requirement of 15 hours. What will happen there is their federal tax refresher course will reduce down to 3 hours and will not require the passing of an exam following the course. Individuals in this program will have to agree that they will be covered by the provisions of Circular 230 while they're part of the program. As well, individuals that have been barred from representing taxpayers under Circular 230, that is, let's say CPAs, EAs, or attorneys that have been disbarred or suspended, will be prohibited from being part of this program, as are those who will not be up to, who are currently not up to date with their filing requirements. The program makes clear that it does not change the status of CPAs, EAs, or attorneys in representing clients before the IRS. It is not meant that they will be required to get this certification. As well, anybody who completes this cannot use the term certified, enrolled, or licensed to describe their designation, nor can they imply an employer-employee relationship with the IRS or make a representation that the IRS has endorsed them in some form. All they can say is that they hold a valid annual filing season program record of completion for the tax year, nice long term, and that you've complied with IRS requirements for receiving that. This program has garnered complaints from both the AICPA and the National Association of Enrolled Agents. The NAEA wrote a letter before the program came out in May complaining that the program was unnecessary and didn't really solve the problem that was being addressed. The AICPA issued a more strongly worded letter following the issuance of the notice that this program was coming out, specifically calling the program unlawful and improper. The AICPA in the letter sent to the IRS made the following 4 points. Number one, the AICPA says no statute authorized the IRS to have this program. Second, basically the AICPA stated that this program will inevitably be seen as an end run around the Loving case. And let's be honest, that's clearly what the point of the program was. So point two would probably be conceded by the IRS. They may not like the term end run, but certainly it's a response to Loving. Third, the IRS, they said, has evidently concluded in developing the program it need not comply with the notice and comment requirements of the Administrative Procedure Act. And the AICPA says this is incorrect. You can read that line as stating that the AICPA just told you under what grounds they are likely to go to court to attempt to block the program. And finally, they said the current program is arbitrary and capricious because it fails to address the problems presented by unethical return preparers, runs counter to the evidence the IRS had put together regarding the problem preparers, and will create market confusion. Effectively, the complaint is that those individuals who are the bad preparers that are out there preparing returns that don't know what they're doing will simply not get this certification either, and they will continue to prepare returns. The public will not be aware of what's going on, and probably the reason for the AICPA and NAEA's concerns in fundamental ways, there may be an idea that somehow these people who get this certification are somehow more qualified, shall we say, than a CPA or EA. So we'll see how that goes. The NAEA and AICPA both had those letters. Given the fact that the AICPA used very strong words, the word specifically unlawful is one that catches your eye very quickly, it seems likely that there may be some court action coming up if the service continues forward with this program, as it appears they will from issuing the revenue procedure, and it may be something to follow in the future to see what happens with the upcoming tax season. The IRS this week issued final regulations on the a small employer health care tax credit as it works following 2013. This was found in Treasury Decision 9672, issuing the final regulations, basically adopting what had been in the proposed regulations issued last year. Remember that 2014 begins a revised Section 45R small employer credit. The percentages change, and most importantly, under the new program, the coverage must be obtained from a SHOP program, that is the state and local small group health care programs. Those requirements take effect this year. What ends up happening under this particular ruling is that the IRS has issued various rules under this that cover some specialized issues. Generally, these rules go ahead and incorporate the guidance that had previously been given in notices 2010-44 and 2010-82. We notes, of course, that we must use the SHOP plan. They do have some special fiscal year issues if, in fact, an employer had a fiscal year health plan. And they had that fiscal year as of August 26, 2013. That was when the proposed regs were issued. The employer will be considered to be offering qualifying coverage this year so long as they move to a SHOP plan on the first day of the new year for their health care plan that begins in 2014. If a employer already had, did not have a fiscal year, if they move to a fiscal year after August 26, they will not be able to make use of this. Remember that beginning this year, the program and the credits only available for two consecutive years. The law provides there's only 2 years once the SHOP program begins. And it begins with the one which employer first offers one or more qualified plans to its employees via a SHOP exchange. The outline also goes through details of how you can meet the uniform coverage requirements. Remember, the employer, to get the credit, must pay a uniform percentage, not lower than 50% of the premium for each employee. The regulations go through some details of the special cases where an employer offers both employee-only and family coverage and how you can be uniform in those cases and the various options an employer has to maintain the feel that it is a uniform offering with some options there, as well as the special issues covered if an employer, rather than being given a straight rate that is the same for everybody, is given a rate that is set up or covered by each employee. They come up with methods that can be used to determine a uniform percentage in that case, including effectively creating what will be a uniform rate by getting an average across the group. The plan has some other special rules in place that help us cover this issue. It also cross-references special rulings that we had because there were some areas and some counties that did not have available SHOP exchanges for this year. There are some special transition rules issued in prior notices that the regulations make, that the preamble to the regs make reference to, that suggests you can take a look there for relief this year if you are an employer who is able to meet the eligibility requirements. Finally, the Treasury Department and the IRS did make one modification. They came to understand that at least one state requires employers to contribute a certain percentage to an employee's premium cost, but also requires that an employee's contribution cannot exceed a certain percentage of gross earnings. What that could cause a problem for is, let's presume that we have one employee where our standard program would require them to have a contribution that is in excess of the maximum allowed percentage. That means that we have to reduce that person's contribution and increase the employer's contribution to their coverage. As was pointed out in comments to the proposed regs, such an employer, if having to keep the percentage uniform for everybody, would be effectively required to go back and increase the contribution for everybody, not just that one employee, making the plan much more costly for the employer. Under the final regulations, an employer can ignore the fact that he or she has to adjust under state law the contribution, increasing it for a single employee. If that's the reason why the contribution was increased for a single employee, the employer is allowed to ignore that and still be treated as making a uniform percentage and qualify for this particular program. The final regulations apply to taxable years beginning after December 31st, 2013, However, employers who want to can still rely upon the proposed regulations that were issued last year for tax years beginning after 2013 and before 2015, or for calendar individuals, obviously, the 2014 tax year. Another final regulation that came out this week was Treasury Decision 9673. This enabled the purchase of qualified longevity annuity contracts for participants in defined contribution plans and IRAs. Now, you might wonder, what's a qualified longevity annuity contract? The idea behind this is that someone in one of these plans, remember, defined contribution plan, you have an account balance, you have one in IRA yourself, that is your balance and you get the earnings. Generally, minimum distributions from such a plan are based each year on a person's balance in the account. What this program will allow somebody to do is to divert up to 25% or $125,000 in the account to the purchase of what is called a qualified longevity annuity contract. This contract is an annuity that begins paying not at age 70 and a half, but has a deferred payout that can be pushed back all the way to age 85, theoretically allowing for a longer payout down the line and or giving the employee a cushion that assures that he or she cannot outlive their benefit. The maximum contribution, as noted, is 25% of the balance of the account, but no more than $125,000. That's the amount that goes to pay premium on a qualified longevity annuity contract. That amount will be taken out of the balance and will not be used in computing required minimum distributions at age 70 and a half. That contract is treated virtually as if going off to the side and hiding. There are limits on what that contract can provide as a death benefit. The IRS did modify the regs to allow the contract to allow for an individual to have a provision in it that states that if after a payout starts at age 85, if they don't recover the entire balance they paid in premiums, that the remaining unrecovered balance of the premiums could be paid out to their heirs. That's in order to help attract it. The idea of this program is to, hopefully, the theory being, have employees stash back funds and not exhaust the retirement funds so that when they get to their older age, they are not going to be stuck and be destitute having exhausted defined contribution plans. This particular program is now effective. The one catch is you're going to have to modify plans and programs to allow for this benefit to be offered, but the IRS has now adopted these regulations as final. Another thing the IRS did this week, and this came in the form of issuing a new form, 1023EZ, modification of regulations, so we got Treasury Decision 9674 with revised regulations, and Revenue Procedure 2014-40. We are going to get a simplified form 1023EZ that can be used for small tax-exempt organizations when they apply for their exempt status. The new three-page form, which, by the way, must be filed electronically. You cannot file this on paper. In fact, when you print it out from the IRS website, there will be a big watermark telling you that you have to file this electronically and cannot file it on paper. Is much simpler than the 26-page full Form 1023 that previously was filed to get exempt status for the organizations. However, that's a little deceptive because before you actually use the 1023EZ, you should go and get the instructions because there is a questionnaire with 26 questions that are used to determine if you are eligible. Entities that cannot meet all 26 requirements will still need to file the full Form 1023 and go through the full program. Those who do qualify will file online electronically, paying a $400 user fee. The IRS will impose that and collect that at the time of the application. The IRS, in announcing this program, made clear that what the IRS wants to do is spend less time looking at the applications. What the IRS has discovered is a huge proportion of the applications come from very, very small not-for-profits, and that the IRS felt they were wasting a lot of time by going through detailed applications for small not-for-profits and dealing with a lot of concepts in those 26-page documents that were causing confusions that really weren't necessary for the small not-for-profits. And the IRS's bigger concern is that the real problem with those not-for-profits is not getting them set up correctly up front in terms of getting them through the process, but their operational progress. The IRS has made clear that what they hope to do by freeing up part of the staff from having to go through and check these applications in detail is to free them up for examinations on the back end. So this may not turn out to be a very, shall we say, friendly change, not at least not as friendly as you might think, for not-for-profits, because what it does suggest is the IRS is going to be looking much more carefully at ramping up examinations and looking at the actual operations of the not-for-profit and not spending nearly as much time looking at the details of the application. The other item to remember, the mere fact they didn't look at those details does not mean that when they come in and do the exam that they will not find that in fact your documents and your structure is flawed, flaws that might have been uncovered had we gone through the full process. This particular program took effect on July 1st of this year, so at this point we are now able to use and run the Form 1023-EZ for small not-for-profits. The next case up is a corporate case, Wells Fargo & Company. The Wells Fargo case, in this case, was a case of first impression that came before the United States Court of Claims. And it looked at the question of, is there a difference between merged corporations and affiliated groups when we look at the interest netting rules? The issue became Section 6621D allows a taxpayer to net overpayments and underpayments for the computation of interest when the IRS is assessing based on prior years. This is key because, remember, the interest rates on underpayments are higher than the interest rates on overpayments. So if the IRS is able to run those separately, they're going to get a collection on effectively an arbitrage of rates, even if, in fact, given all the taxes and issues in play, there is no net overpayment or underpayment, that in essence, at no time did we really owe the government money because every dollar we owed them could be offset by a dollar they owed us back, but from a different return. The issue here becomes what happens if we merge taxpayers. Now, there had been previous cases where entities had become part of an affiliated group, and that case law had made very clear in prior cases that affiliated groups did not get this netting. Cases there, they look at Energy E Corp versus the United States from 2011 and Magma Power Company in 2011, both held that if a party was not part of the affiliated group in 1 year, then became part of the affiliated group in a later year, that you weren't allowed for that year when it was not part of the affiliated group to take its overpayment or underpayment and include that in your netting provision under 6621. However, this case looked different. Wells Fargo had been involved in mergers. In what is basically an A reorganization or a statutory merger, is that different? Now, here we had, as all of you are probably aware, there were a number of banks that over time got merged into and became part of what is today known as Wells Fargo & Company. In fact, it's interesting reading the case. You can find a whole bunch of old bank names that are in there that now are part of Wells Fargo. And in fact, as we should all be aware, what we call Wells Fargo today is really what was previously Norwest Bank, and the old Wells Fargo actually disappeared and was merged into Norwest Bank. Norwest became the successor, but took the name Wells Fargo. Now the question becomes, we have all these old banks lying around, and there are overpayments and underpayments, IRS exams going on. Is the new Wells Fargo allowed to net? The IRS says, no. Based on those affiliated group cases, if the entities did not file using the same EIN, they are not the same taxpayer. And 6621 only allows netting for the same taxpayer. Wells Fargo says, no, a statutory merger is different because a statutory merger, the old taxpayer ceases to exist. And essentially, the two old taxpayers are combined into what now becomes a single taxpayer. So that the merged company today really is the same taxpayer as the old standalone companies from back a few years ago. The Court of Claims agreed that this had not really been decided, And the court also agreed that the IRS generally, in most other areas, treats a merged entity as a pure 100% successor to all of the previous companies that were involved in the merger. So the Court of Claims decided that for purposes of 6621, this is still going to be allowed for netting for a merged company to be able to make use of and offset interest over offset overpayments and underpayments for purposes of computing interest that is due. It will be interesting to see if the IRS decides to appeal this decision or if the IRS tries to find a different venue to try this case in. Remember, this is the Court of Claims. It would go to the Federal Circuit. If you decide to try to make use of this at this moment, the only place we're aware this is going to work for sure is in the Court of Claims. If you're not going to take your case there, then you're going to have to hope that the courts in your area decide to follow this interest netting option and or we're going to get a split. So this will be interesting to watch going forward. Finally, let's take a look at the case of Heckman versus Commissioner. This is a tax court memorandum decision, 2014-131. This particular case deals with the six-year statute of limitations, the extended six-year statute, under Internal Revenue Code Section 6501E1 Cap A. Remember, if we omit 25% or more of gross income from a return, rather than having a three-year statute of limitations, the IRS is given a six-year statute under which to assess tax due. In this particular case, the taxpayer had formed an ESOP that, to be charitable, had problems. In fact, the problems have been conceded in this case before we even get to the question at hand. The taxpayer had conceded that the ESOP was, in fact, not qualified. Therefore, when it made a distribution, which he rolled over into an IRA, that was not eligible to be rolled over into the IRA. Therefore, obviously, if we have distribution of funds that are not eligible to be rolled over, we have income that could not be offset. And he agreed that, in fact, there should have been income reported in a year that was outside the three-year statute. That was all agreed before we got to court. The only issue being argued at court was whether or not, under the rules, we knew he had omitted over 25% of income. But there is an exception to this. If you adequately disclosed the existence of the potential item of income, the six-year statute goes away. So if the IRS was given sufficient information where it should have been able to determine there was a potential understatement and failed to do so within the 3 years, then the six-year statute does not come into play, even if there was such an omission of income. In this case, the taxpayer claimed, well, he didn't put anything about the rollover on his return for the year in question. So it's clear it's not on his 1040. But what the taxpayer said was that effectively, the IRS had information that should have allowed them to understand that this case, that this particular issue existed. For instance, a Schedule K-1 attached to the partnership return that was part of what was distributed out of the ESOP clearly reflected the partner was the taxpayer's IRA. As well, the Form SS-4 that was filed to obtain a taxpayer identification number for the partnership that was formed as part of this transaction that got rolled into the IRA identified the taxpayer as a general managing member of the LLC. And the Form 5498 filed for the IRA listed the taxpayer as the owner of the nominee account held by the custodian. So, according to the taxpayer, the IRS should have been able to quickly conclude that he had an interest in the partnership, it went into the IRA, and also they claimed a late filed 5500 should have let the IRS know that it had come from the ESOP. The tax court disagreed. In essence, they said these documents gave no clue about the existence, nature, or amount of the omitted income. At best, the court concluded, they reveal only that the taxpayer and or his IRA are members of a partnership. In the case is, the IRS is not required to go far afield trying to figure out if there might be some vague clue or something vaguely related to the transaction and somehow divine from that that there might be omitted income. Rather, the court said, the taxpayer offered few clues, not enough clues on the return to qualify for disclosure to the IRS about the existence of this issue. Therefore, the court found the six-year statute was open, and since all other issues had effectively been conceded, the court found that the taxpayer owed tax for the year in question. This concludes this week's Nichols Patrick Federal Tax Update, presented to you by Nichols Patrick CPE and your State Society of CPAs. Be sure to check back in next week when we'll take a look at the more recent developments that occur in the coming weeks with regard to federal tax issues.